It's the smell of fresh cut construction wood, and it reminds me of camp that I went to when I was a kid because they had just built the cabins the first year that I went.
Why do smells bring back memories? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
It is the cutting edge of what modern neuroscience can do.
Brain injury survivors still are capable of doing many things.
I think there's a notion that researchers are in some sort of ivory tower.
This is my health.
We're not just a body, we're not just a head.
Robots are really just computers with motors.
The speed at which they can process information, flow, their ability to filter.
In addition to your knee pain, you're also dealing with insomnia.
Diagnosed.
On today's show, new insights into the origins of our oceans, the psychology of losing, and germs in space. But first up, smells have the almost magical quality of being able to transport us back to a specific time and place with one sniff, an olfactory time machine of sorts. Think, for example, the salty smell of the beach.
Memorial Day starts the official start of summer, so whenever we go down the shore for the first time and you smell the bay for the first time, you're like, oh, yep, summer started.
Or food smells.
The Belgium waffles remind me of when I went to Belgium and I had my first Belgium waffle in 1984 in a cafe in the middle of the night in the cold.
The holiday season is rife with this phenomenon, and Carolyn Beeler went to find out why smells are so good at bringing back old memories.
My olfactory time machine is the incense Catholic priests burn at the altar on special holidays. Whenever that sticky, sweet scent hits my nostrils, I'm transported back to the Christmas Eve masses of my childhood.
She wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger.
I immediately remember the drama of the Christmas story read from the pulpit.
Now there were shepherds in that region living in the fields.
The glow of candles lighting the church and the giddy anticipation of opening presents the next morning.
As we make these in all of our prayers through Christ our Lord.
So why does that smell of incense mean Christmas to me so much more than hearing a Christmas carol or the sensation of tearing open a wrapped gift? I went to the Center of All Things Sensory in Philadelphia for an answer.
I'm Pamela Dalton from the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia.
Before diving into the memory thing, Dalton gives me a primer on what happens when we smell.
So let's say you're smelling incense. These molecules that are coming from the incense are sniffed into your nose so that it makes contact with our olfactory receptors, which are located very high up in the nasal cavity, sort of right behind the bridge of your nose.
The scent molecules bind to those olfactory receptors in a specific pattern.
Once that pattern is formed, that signal is sent to the brain where it's processed first by what we call the primary olfactory cortex.
This is the first way that smell differs from other senses.
Because all other sensory systems are routed through a structure in the brain called the thalamus, which is sort of like a gatekeeper.
But smell, that bypasses this gatekeeper.
And goes directly to the primary olfactory cortex. And that may be why we experience odors in a different way than we do other kinds of sensory stimuli.
Dalton calls the thalamus the consciousness detector. Because scent isn't routed through the thalamus, smells can enter our brains and attach to memories without us consciously registering or processing them, even when we're asleep. A second reason odors seem to be so tightly associated with emotional memories is due to how the brain is structured.
This olfactory area that processes the information is very close proximity to a part of the brain that processes emotional information and in particular emotional memories, the limbic system and the hippocampus and the amygdala.
These structures are all clustered at the center of the brain and they developed together in our evolutionary ancestors. Smell is the first sense our predecessors had, and Dalton says it was designed to immediately send an emotional signal. Good or bad, approach or retreat, eat or avoid. So neurology and evolution both play a role in this memory-triggering phenomenon. A third factor lies outside the brain, and it has to do with language.
Let us give thanks to the Lord our God.
Back at church on Christmas Eve, I can identify the particular shade of the altar cover as white or cream-colored or beige, but since I don't make perfume or taste wine for a living, I lack the same vocabulary for the incense the priest is burning. It's maybe sweet, slightly musky, holy-smelling. We can't label, intellectualize, and analyze odors as much as sights or sounds. So Dalton argues what we're left with is emotion.
I think somehow being able to describe something very specifically may remove some of the aura of emotion from it.
I don't know what kind of incense the priest uses, so instead of filing that scent away under myrrh or frankincense in my brain, it's just Christmas.
So when we smell an odor, rather than labeling it as the odor of something, very often it just becomes associated to the context that we're in at the time.
Retailers are capitalizing on that contextual connection to draw people into their stores this time of year. Scent Air is a company that designs signature scents for businesses in more than 100 countries. This time of year, Scent Air CEO Andy Kindfuller says many of his retail clients switch to holiday aromas.
So as an example, let me take one of the very popular holiday scents that we use called Holiday Spice.
That scent aims to create new memories of shopping to draw people back to brick-and-mortar stores in an age of online retail. And it taps into happy holiday memories of the past.
It brings back to the consumer memories that they have, maybe from their childhood, where they were around pine needles or were eating oranges and berries at the holiday time. And those memories come back to them and again makes them feel better about that retailer.
Kindfuller says one major clothing retailer started using a woodsy pine scent in early November to remind people to start their Christmas shopping. Scent memories are fragile things, though. Overexposure can reduce the emotional punch. That's why Lou McCall, who sells spruces and firs at Philadelphia's Christmas Village, doesn't think Christmas anymore when he smells evergreens.
I have absolutely been desensitized. I don't even know what a Christmas tree smells like anymore. So I lift so many of these and been doing it for a couple years, and if anything, whatever the tree smell may be reminds me, it just smells like work.
For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We might be getting a bit closer to answering one of the oldest questions in planetary science. Where did our oceans come from? So far, a leading assumption has been that a bombardment of comets almost 4 billion years ago brought with them the water that now makes up our oceans. But a study released last week raises questions about that. The data came from the Rosetta spacecraft, and joining us now to explain these findings is Dr. Claudia Alexander of NASA. She's the project scientist for the U.S. Rosetta Project. Claudia, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What is the name of the comet?
We are very close to and in orbit around comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko.
So can you tell us a little bit more about that comet?
It's a comet that was first observed in 1955. It was discovered by two Russian astronomers, Churyumov and Gerasimenko, both of them. It is a very strange-looking target. It looks like a rubber duck, or to me it looks like the boot from the Monopoly game. So it looks like it has actually two smaller objects that crash together to make one giant object.
So explain to us what the particles that have been gathered, what can they tell us about where the Earth's oceans did or did not come from?
So we were looking to measure a particular particle called deuterium. And this is the same particle that is in heavy water. So heavy water, water is normally H2O, and heavy water is deuterium, D2O. And looking at that ratio, most of the comets that we have measured up until now through the decades have not had any value. So the water did not have the same flavors as Earth's water in terms of the relationship of deuterium to hydrogen, D2O, relative to H2O. But suddenly, just a few years ago, with Comet Hartley 2, which is the first Kuiper Belt comet that we measured, we got an exact terrestrial value. So that was very exciting. It said, look, comets from the Kuiper Belt might have been the rain of material that brought ocean water and hydrated the Earth, giving us this mantle of water that is even deeper than the oceans. We know that the upper mantle of the Earth is also very hydrated with water. So we were hoping that the measurement that we would get of deuterium from Rosetta would be the same, that would confirm the idea that a Kuiper Belt object brought the water to the Earth. But it turns out that it is vastly different. The value is even more different than some of the other comets from the Oort cloud. So it means we have some more thinking to do about where did Earth get its water, and could Earth have brought out its own water?
Is there still a chance that the water came from the comets, or is that being ruled out now?
Yes, I believe that comets are not they're not homogeneous. So you have many, many different kinds of very heterogeneous objects out there. And it's very possible that a subset, let's say 10% of comets from the Kuiper Belt may have had an important role in hydrating Earth's oceans and Earth's upper crust. It's possible also that Earth might have outgassed a certain amount of water from its original material.
And what are some, are there other theories on how the oceans got there?
Yes, there's some idea now that maybe material that was closer to the edge, the outer edge of the asteroid belt, might have been water rich and might have brought that water to the inner solar system, hydrating both Mars and Earth and perhaps Venus. There's also an idea that whatever it was that hydrated Earth may have also hydrated the asteroids. You know, we talked about, well, maybe it was asteroids because asteroids are now being discovered to have water on them. We have a new class of asteroids called main belt comets that exhibit material like a comet tail and comet coma with water vapor. But it's possible that there was what we call wet planetesimals, or in the early days when we had these forming bodies called planetesimals, some of them had a lot of water. They were out near the orbit of Jupiter, and maybe that class of objects was raining down and hydrating everything in the inner solar system. So I can't tell you today which of those theories is correct. This is some of the work that we're gathering the clues, and then this would be some of the work that we have to do.
So 2015 could be a very big year for comet science.
Yes, this is not only going to be a big year for comet science, but it will be a big year for piecing together bits of the story of the solar system. And that will include doing corroborative measurements with the Dawn mission, which will arrive at asteroid Ceres also this year, and the New Horizons mission, which will arrive at Pluto this year. And hopefully all three of these missions will tell a complementary story that will help us all to learn more about the origins of our solar system.
And one last question. What is a very simple distinction between a comet and an asteroid?
In the old days, the very simplest distinction was that an asteroid was basically a chunk of rock. Meteorites that fall on the ground are chunks of asteroids. And so it's kind of very simple. You have a rock versus a snowflake. That was really the easiest way to understand the difference. But now, the closer we get to comets and the more we look at what the dusty refractory material is versus what is the evolved form maybe of asteroids, there's like a giant gray area or maybe one continuum between the rocky form, which is the asteroid, and the icy, dusty, rich form, which is the comet. And how that continuum maybe played a role in forming the planets and seeding them with, let's say, organic materials and the material that may have led to life, is part of the interesting questions we'll be looking at this year.
Claudia, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Claudia Alexander is project scientist for the U.S. Rosetta Project.
Coming up on The Pulse, scientists at a Philly lab may be sitting on a major breakthrough.
There's nothing that comes close to going to bed at night knowing something you are the only person in the history of mankind to know. Doesn't get any better than that.
We'll find out what that something is, still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. IBC believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. With doctors and hospitals across the region, Independence Blue Cross is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support designed to help you live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. If at first you don't succeed, try again. That's what our parents always told us, right? But try as they might, the Philadelphia 76ers can't seem to win. And as Shai Ben-Yakov reports, the team's many losses might be affecting the body chemistry of its young would-be stars.
The 76ers are not doing well.
Philly goes down by 7. They set a new team record with 16 straight losses.
At the half, Philadelphia was down 44 points.
Spurs hold on to win by 6 for their 8th straight win. Philly has lost 17 in a row.
You get the idea. Now, the Sixers weren't all that great last season. They tied an NBA record for consecutive losses last spring, becoming the butt of late-night television.
The last time someone in Philly had that much trouble on a basketball court, he was sent to live with his auntie and uncle in Bel Air. Oh, yeah, that's...
Making light of the Sixers' situation is about all you can do to elevate the mood at games. Earlier this week, a little over 12,000 fans spread out among the more than 20,000 seats at the Wells Fargo Center. Despite an early lead, the Sixers went on to lose to the Celtics by nearly 20 points. Later, Coach Brett Brown couldn't even muster the energy to pretend to be proud of his team.
It was the first time for me personally in a while where you're trying to search for answers and I didn't have any. I really didn't.
The team's controversial strategy for success is well documented. They're tanking. That means they've traded away all of their good veteran players in the hopes of drafting high-level young players in the future. If they do badly enough this year, the team will probably end up with one of the top three draft picks next year. They already have four recent first-rounders on the team. All have talent, but they're young and raw, and without veterans around them, they don't have much of a chance right now. The plan is to have enough good players mature at the same time that the Sixers will be a dominant team in 3 or 4 years. But here's the problem with that plan.
Your self-concept changes to gradually from being that of a winner to being that of a loser.
That's Ian Robertson. He's chair of psychology at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. He's also the author of the book The Winner Effect, The Neuroscience of Success and Failure. We spoke via Skype. Robertson says both winning and losing can have real effects on the body.
It turns out that winning actually generates an increase in testosterone in your body in both men and women. And that in turn increases dopamine levels in what's called the reward network in the brain, which means that the next time you win, the testosterone that you have will have a bigger effect and make you more motivated, more aggressive, and hence more likely to win.
That's when you win. But when you lose...
Losing produces a surge of the stress hormone cortisol. Losing is very painful, and you get actually a dip and the dopamine activity.
Now, Robertson says if you're lucky, your body will rally and produce enough testosterone to get you back your competitive edge.
But if you've been in a situation of repeated losing, you're likely to have a much less prolonged or a much lower rise in testosterone in anticipation of the clash. And in fact, you're more likely to have an anticipatory burst of cortisol, the stress hormone, which may actually interfere with your performance.
In other words, by losing again and again, these players may actually be teaching their bodies to sabotage themselves. Remember, some of those players are ones the franchise intends to keep. They're players who came into the league at the very top of their sport. Most have been identifying themselves as winners for a long time, and now all of a sudden, they're not. It doesn't really take a neuroscientist to draw this conclusion. Here's ESPN commentator Adnan Virk.
You think you can just acquire callow youth, have them browbeaten into submission, pummeled by the pain of nightly thrashing, and then a light switch will come on, and you can say, presto, it's time for us to contend now. Just doff your loser hats and put on that winning smile.
Well, some say that actually might be possible.
You have to have the team view this challenge optimistically versus pessimistically.
That's sports psychologist Dr. Corey Bank. Bank says if the team brass goes to great pains to paint a bright picture of the future, the players could rebound, so to speak.
So if they're a pessimist, we're losing because we're awful. This is going to last for years and years and years and decades, and it's going to affect, you know, my psychological health, my physical health, my relationships with my friends and family, my relationships with my teammates.
But Bank says optimists have a different point of view.
They look at this challenge as external. We're a very young team, and it's external, and it's also temporary. It might, you know, not be a week or a month. It might be a year or 2 years, but this is not going to be happening my entire career.
Whether Sixers fans believe in the tanking strategy or not, they can probably look forward to many more games like the one I saw. But hey, they can always wipe away those tears with a T-shirt shot out of a cannon. For The Pulse, I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov.
Joining us now for some Curious Science updates is regular Pulse contributor SciCurious, Bethany Brookshire. She's a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. Hi, Bethany.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Let's start with some news on yet another thing pregnant women shouldn't do. We hear all the time these kind of missives, don't eat this, do eat that. So what's the news?
High-fat diets.
Yes. Yes or no?
It's tough to say. So this is a bunch of research that I found during the yearly Society for Neuroscience meeting, which was held this year in Washington. And there were several avenues of research looking at the impact of high-fat diets during pregnancy on the offspring.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting about this was the research was not just in mice or not just in rats. It was actually in mice and rats and monkeys.
Okay.
So it runs across species. And they found several things. One group looking in mice showed that high-fat diets during pregnancy actually caused changes in the offspring, giving them bad memory function. They weren't able to find a platform while they were swimming as easily as mice that had moms that had been on a low-fat diet. Another one in rats actually showed that the offspring of moms on a high-fat diet showed anxiety-like and depressive-like behaviors.
So, Bethany, are we talking about the so-called good fats or the bad fats, the saturated fats?
We're talking more about the bad fats, like the saturated fatty acids, you know, things found in your butters and your oils that in low doses are plenty good for you, but it turns out a high-fat diet may not be so great.
And Bethany, are there any new recommendations now about what the fat percentage should be for a pregnant woman's diet?
No. Now, keep in mind, all of the studies that I was looking at were in animals. They were in rats, they were in mice, they were in monkeys. They are not studies in humans. So it's not really clear if it will translate to humans. And also, this is just a diet. You know, it could be mitigated by things like exercise. There could be other diets, like maybe a high sugar diet, that's more harmful. Maybe you're better off high fat. You know, so I think it's too early to say, but it is very fascinating and, of course, gives moms-to-be yet another thing to freak out about.
Right. We're not quite sure yet, but begin to worry anyway. Bethany, you recently wrote about a research chamber built entirely out of
Legos. What was that all about?
Oh, this is so fun. So it was a high school student. His name is Andy Gallup, and he was a high school student up in Bar Harbor, Maine. And he used Lego Mindstorms to build something called an operant chamber or Skinner box. And these chambers are commonly used in animal behavior, especially in research for things like drug addiction. So what happens is you put a mouse in the box and there's levers that come out and a light that comes on. So when the light comes on, the lever comes out. And when the mouse hits a lever, it gets something nice. Maybe it's like a sucrose pellet. Maybe it's a little bit of, you know, milk or something else that a mouse likes. And after a little while trying this, the mouse pretty quickly figures out to hang around near the lever waiting for the sugar, so that he can press the lever when the light comes on. And this is a good way to train mice, obviously, but it's also a good way to demonstrate to teens how drug addiction works, because it shows how you can teach a mouse and how you can teach a human a habit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great way to kind of give hands-on insight into drug addiction. And that's what they're hoping for, because a lot of drug addiction teaching in high school is very much focused on the whole just say no mentality, which is fine, but they think that it would be a lot more powerful if teens learned more about how addiction worked. And they can. They can build their own operant chamber out of Legos.
So how many Legos did he use?
I don't know how many Legos. I know the total cost was actually around $600.
Wow.
For the Lego Mindstorms. That sounds like a lot, but compared to an operant chamber that you would actually buy, that's a pretty cheap price tag.
And what does this Lego Skinner box look like?
There's actually a picture on the Eureka Lab website. It looks like a little square box with a gray floor. There's a little rotating thing on top that helps to dispense the sugar pellets. And there's little levers that come out and lights that turn on. Actually, if you've ever seen a real metal operant chamber, it looks just like that, only Legos.
How big are they, just roughly? Like a coffee table?
It's about a foot square.
Okay. Bethany Brookshire, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bethany Brookshire of Science News. She writes for the educational blog Eureka Lab. You're listening to The Pulse. Airports, cars, bars, the gym, anywhere there's a power source, there's probably somebody trying to charge their phone. As far as portable technologies have come this decade, we are still only as mobile as our batteries allow us to be. So what if your next gadget charged up not in hours, but in seconds? Todd Bookman reports on a recent breakthrough that could untether us from the outlet.
Inside a ground floor lab, Michael Gadoo spreads out the tools and materials he needs to make something called Maxine clay.
This is what it looks like. You can see it goes from a kind of a lighter gray color as a powder to a black when it's hydrated. So I'm going to put it in between some water permeable sheets here.
The 25-year-old grad student smears some of the substance onto the white squares. Picture a pie crust going in between two layers of wax paper. Then, using a rolling pin, or in this case, just the round surface of a bottle, Gadoo flattens the clay out.
Once it dries, you should be able to peel these apart, and then you have a film that looks like this.
He holds up an already dry version. To the naked eye, it really doesn't look all that interesting. But the titanium carbide-based clay is remarkable. For starters, the individual layers that make the stuff up are really thin.
One nanometer, which is a billionth of a meter.
Drexel professor Michel Barsoom, who is advising Gadoo's PhD work, says that thinness means more power can be stored in between the layers. It's also conductive, making the clay a potential breakthrough material in the $30 billion field of lithium-ion power storage. A quick background. Today, there's batteries, which can hold a lot of power but charge slowly, and there's something called supercapacitors, supercaps. They recharge quickly but can't hold as much juice.
Now, what we are trying to do is we're trying to do something that I don't think people thought was possible, which is to move supercaps into the realm of batteries.
So if the clay can combine the best of both worlds, that means a portable power source that won't degrade over time. Today, cell phone and laptop batteries have relatively short lifespans because the daily charging and discharging breaks down the chemicals inside. Barsoom says it's not a huge stumbling block because they're usually cheap to replace.
But if you're going to make electric cars, the battery pack is of the order of $10,000. So there's no way you're going to buy a new pack for your car every 2 years at $10,000 a pop. So that's a very big issue.
Drexel's Clay has been put through 10,000 charge-recharge cycles without showing any signs it weakens over time. Researcher and 26-year-old Maria Lukatskaya says it also has the ability to fuel up lightning fast.
So by using supercapacitors instead of batteries, what we can do, we can charge phone in several seconds.
As good as that sounds, don't expect to find the Clay in your next iPhone. The team still needs to increase how much charge it can hold. Scientists measure that ability in units called farads. Right now, Maxine is at 900.
This is not even first generation. This is zero generation. If in a year we don't double this number, please come back and interview me, all right? Because then we really don't know what we're doing.
12 months may be a self-imposed milestone for Barsoom, but the industry's timeline for new materials typically stretches out much longer.
People want it to be down at 15 years. It's typically more like 25 to 30 years. So it's a slow process. I mean, people have a very strong reluctance to use new materials.
Maxine could get a boost, though, because the substance is easy to make and shape into electrodes. It also likes water, which simplifies the manufacturing process.
I cannot conceive of an easier, cheaper way to do it. And remember, at the end of the day, it's cost that's going to drive most things, right? Especially consumer products. So that's why we're sort of bullish on these materials.
Professor Barsoom says whatever the long-term outcome for the clay, he's thrilled his students, Michael and Maria, are able to savor such a major discovery so early in their careers.
There's nothing that comes close to going to bed at night knowing something you are the only person in the history of mankind to know. Doesn't get any better than that.
Some decent money down the road could make it a little sweeter. The team has filed for a patent on its Maxine-making process. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Coming up on The Pulse, a profile of a self-described outlaw scientist.
He came to the conclusion I had stolen government property and assumed that I was a thief.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to meet your needs. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. This year, Philadelphia's prestigious John Scott Award for Innovation went to a biologist who waged a long battle with the government over who has a right to profit from his discoveries. He laid a lot of the groundwork that led to vaccine development. Tanya English has this profile of Leonard Hayflick.
I was asked to present some anecdotes that led to the John Scott Award.
In November, when the 86-year-old took the stage to accept his award, Hayflick was at times charming, then boastful. He cast himself as an outlaw scientist, kind of like the bank robber Slick Willie Sutton.
When asked why he robbed banks, he famously replied, "Because that's where the money is." So I used overhead funds illegally because that is where the scientific freedom is.
Hayflick says his bandit approach to science began at one of Philadelphia's leading research centers, the Wistar Institute. In the early 1960s, he created a strain of cells called WI-38 for Wistar 38. It was a huge success at a time when getting cells to reliably multiply in the lab was more of an art than a science.
Without WI38, the rubella vaccine, for example, would never have been successful because by growing it in normal human cells, it acquired characteristics that made it desirable for vaccine production.
He and partner Paul Moorhead cultivated clean human cells that became a platform for vaccine development. Hayflick is proud of that, but seems bitter about what's happened since.
Moorhead and I have received not a penny, not even acknowledgement from the Wistar Institute in respect to our role in giving value to the cells from which they profit in the millions.
The Institute declined to talk about Hayflick's dispute, but there is no dispute that WI38 cells were used to produce vaccines against German measles, chickenpox, rabies, and hepatitis A.
And these vaccines by now have saved millions of lives. They have been used in billions of children. So that is really where, in my mind, the true value of this cell line is.
That's Hildegun Erdl. She leads vaccine research at Wistar. She says back when scientists were using monkey cells or cowhide to make vaccines, Hayflick cells offered a safer alternative.
So obviously, if you grow something on the skin of a cow, it's going to come out pretty dirty. And then people have side effects. So you're starting to realize that giving people very dirty vaccines was asking for trouble.
Vaccine innovation has moved on, but Wistar still keeps a few vials of WI38 in the deep freeze.
We keep lots of old stuff. We shouldn't, but we do.
It's a styrofoam container with dry ice. We have to thaw them quickly and get them back at a temperature because they're just like newborns.
The tiny plastic container filled with a pinkish-orange liquid isn't much to look at, but you can see part of Hayflick's legacy as research technician Wynetta Giles Davis demonstrates what it takes to keep cultured cells living and happy.
We gently now mix the cells around, and we just add enough media to keep them going and alive for approximately 24 to 48 hours when they're checked again.
Hayflick helped to advance that science. He says he decided to leave Wistar when he learned that the Institute was going to profit from WI38 through a patent on its own vaccine work.
I took the ampules with me, drove them in my car in a liquid nitrogen tank to California to await a decision.
He moved on to Stanford University, but the dispute over who owned the cells followed him there. The federal government said it owned WI38 and sent an accountant to inventory Hayflick's laboratory.
He came to the conclusion I had stolen government property and assumed that I was a thief.
Hayflick argues that he, Paul Moorhead, and the family from which the cell tissue was taken are the stakeholders who most deserve to share in the profits from WI38.
If you own the ampules, do you own all of the cells that reproduce from that ampule forever and ever?
That question has not been resolved to this day. But after suing the government, eventually Hayflick did settle the case. At the John Scott Awards ceremony in Philadelphia, a member of the selection committee, Harvey Rubin, talked about Hayflick's place among the other innovators.
Somebody wanted for inventing a better front door lock. And I like this one, an easy and expeditious tooth extractor. $20. So you have to measure your scientific achievements against some of these scientific achievements. The work that these men did is actually pretty old. It was done back in the 60s. And we recognize that their achievements haven't been given the level of recognition that we thought it deserved.
Well, I nominated him for this award 10 years ago.
Eugene Garfield says the complicated reputation of Hayflick's work sometimes overshadowed its importance.
The committee always found a reason to give it to somebody else. He's a very determined guy, persistent. Some people might say a nudge.
Lynn Hayflick says he's happy to be known as the person who challenged the government's claim on WI38. He also helped transform attitudes about whether scientists should profit from innovations supported by taxpayer money.
That work that I did to change people's minds was far more important than my laboratory work.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Leonard Hayflick shared this year's Philadelphia John Scott Award with fellow Wistar Institute alum Paul Moorhead. Researcher Susan Band Horwitz was also honored for work that led to a new cancer treatment. And this disclosure, the Wistar Institute is a supporter of WHYY.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Across the country, the shale boom has given rise to fears about whether oil and gas development might be polluting the water we drink and the air we breathe. This has led some residents to try to do their own field research in the mode of citizen science. State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Collinari reports on this tricky blend of science and advocacy.
I'm following Joanne Martin down a steep gravel slope, ducking low tree branches, and trying not to fall on my butt.
There you go. Okay.
We made it.
She's not going to fall now.
Our trek takes us to the muddy bank of Brady Run, a stream in Beaver County in western Pennsylvania. Martin has been coming to Brady Run for 3 years, testing the water for signs of pollution from natural gas drilling. There's a producing well pad just about a half mile from here. First, Martin plunks in a wood measuring stick to check stream depth.
So then I go upstream a little bit because I don't want to take water from where I disturbed the sediment because I don't want any of that in the sample.
She takes a small cup, the kind you might use at a doctor's office, and dips it into the stream.
Ah, it's cold!
Back on the bank, Martin uses a pocket-sized monitor to test her sample.
It is measuring the conductivity of the water. The lower the conductivity, the less potential toxicity of the water. So if there's higher conductivity, it would mean that there might be some metals discharging into the stream.
Martin is not a professional scientist. So why is she standing in the middle of a frigid stream on a December morning? Martin is what is called a citizen scientist, and she's been trained by this woman.
I'm Julie Bastine, and I direct the Alliance for Aquatic Resource Monitoring, acronym ALARM, based out of Dickinson College.
For much of its 28 years, ALARM has encouraged citizen science to help communities answer their own questions about the health of their local watersheds. Then the shale boom hit. Vastine says the big question lately has been how all the drilling and fracking and laying of new pipelines might be affecting Pennsylvania's waterways.
There are limited resources by state agencies, regional agencies to do monitoring, and so it's obvious that we need more boots on the ground to be able to collect water quality data.
ALARM has trained more than 500 volunteers in its strict protocol for sampling local streams and for reporting potential problems to state regulators. Vastine says some people are drawn to the program because they like being part of scientific research. Others, like Joanne Martin, got involved out of worry about fracking's impact on the environment.
When I first started testing, I thought, wow, this would be a perfect opportunity to really, you know, ring the alarm bells and maybe halt the whole production if we actually were to find some contamination in the stream. And really, in the end, no, I don't hope that that happens. But sometimes those are the ways to call attention is when there is a problem.
That's the key for people like Martin. They want the data they're collecting to get regulators and politicians to pay attention.
If you have facts, you can send it in and say, we want this reported. But until we get those facts, we're on our own.
Janice Winshue and her husband Chuck are taking part in a study on air quality near gas development in Pennsylvania's Susquehanna County. Researchers from the University of London gave them an air monitor to keep on their front porch. Every few weeks, they upload the data from the monitor onto their computer. But here's what's different about this study. The researchers are primarily interested not in the air quality readings, but in what the residents do with the data once they're collected. Jennifer Gabrice is a sociologist leading the study.
Citizens are undertaking monitoring already because they have concerns about their environment. How might they actually develop those practices further in order to actually do something with that data, to actually have conversations with policymakers or regulators or even industry?
But should policymakers and regulators trust data from ordinary people motivated by worry? Citizen science has become a norm in fields like astronomy and birding. But some still question whether this method always produces good data. For example, can scientists trust water quality readings collected by people opposed to fracking? David Resnick is a bioethicist at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences.
There is the potential that they could bias their research in a similar kind of way that a company might when it has a financial interest at stake.
Resnick says the work of citizen scientists should be judged the way all science should be judged.
Is it good from a scientific perspective? Is it rigorous? But you also have to ask yourself, well, is it good from an ethical perspective? Does it follow the accepted ethical standards for research?
About a week and a half ago, Chuck Winshoe noticed his air quality monitor had spiked to levels he'd never seen before. A message showed up on the screen.
Danger, unhealthy air.
So the Winshoes called the State Department of Environmental Protection, who sent an inspector later that afternoon, along with an energy company representative.
They were very interested in getting here and to see what this thing was.
I'm sorry to say, I don't feel they were as interested in...
No, they weren't interested in what I was breathing that day. They were interested in, where'd you get this machine?
Exactly.
And why are you air monitoring? You know, they kind of indicated, that's our job. And I'm like, well...
The Winshoes say they still don't know exactly what caused their air monitor to spike that morning, but they believe the DEP would never have shown up if they didn't have that device on their porch. So for them, it's a start. For The Pulse, I'm Katie Colinari.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Preliminary results are in for a science experiment we've been following on the show, Project Mercury. Joining us now is Darlene Cavalier. She's the founder of SciStarter, which promotes citizen science. Hi, Darlene.
Hi, nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Can you sum up the project for us?
Sure. Project Mercury is a study of how microbes behave on Earth and how they behave in space, in particular on the International Space Station. There were three areas of this research project that we were extremely interested in, we being SciStarter, the Science Cheerleaders, and UC Davis, the Eisen Lab. One is to understand the population distribution and behavior of 4,000 samples of microbes taken from shoes and cell phones all around the country. Another was to compare the growth rates of microbes on Earth to those that we sent to the International Space Station. There were 48 of those. And the third was to understand the types of microbes that are lurking on the International Space Station itself. All of this actually gets into looking at some data that would be important for long-term manned space flight.
So you send 48 bacteria samples to space.
Yes.
What happened to them? What do we know so far?
Well, what happened is we did have a slight hardware issue, which meant that these 48 samples stayed frozen for 9 months. But as it turns out, 47 of them survived, grew quite well. One did not, unfortunately, from the Phillies dugout. But the other 47 are thriving in space.
One of the samples came from WHYY, was collected here. How did that sample do in space?
Well, that is one of five finalists right now in the running for what we're calling the best tip-off. So this is for the bacteria that starts growing right away. UC Davis researchers, in particular David Coyle and Russell Neches, measured this by looking at the percentage increase in growth between time zero, which is when the astronauts pull this out of the freezer and start to examine this, and the first growth measurement one day later, 24 hours later.
So, Darlene, generally speaking, what do scientists hope to gain from this experiment?
Well, so we have three different groups that are looking at different aspects of this research project. We have researchers from Argonne National Lab who are extremely interested in the 4,000 samples that were collected and not sent to space. They become part of what's known as the Earth Microbiome Map. So this is creating a baseline measurement of types of bacteria, these microbes, where they exist, and then starting to layer other data to start to look for correlations and patterns. It might be, you know, the first step towards looking at mental health correlations, asthma connections. So it's a baby step towards that research. The other is what we're looking at here with the space, with the differences in the growth rates. That and the third part, looking at the specific types of bacteria that exist on the space station now, are really important in terms of understanding how bacteria behaves in space over time as well. So what we're starting to see, or what the UC Davis researchers are starting to see here, is there doesn't appear to be a lot of difference between what happens with these safe bacteria that we sent to space compared to what's happening back at the lab at UC Davis, which is good because this is very, very common types of bacteria. That's why they were selected to head there. So as NASA starts to think about sending people to Mars, for example, understanding the behavior of common bacteria becomes a very important issue.
Because whoever is going to Mars will be dragging those bacteria
Absolutely.
Along for the ride.
Exactly right.
And we get grossed out sometimes thinking about all the microbes that are on our shoes or on our cell phones, but
These are not all bad guys, right?
No. In particular, the ones that were chosen to live on the International Space Station could not be bad guys because we did not want to infect or make the astronauts living up there sick. That would not have turned out so well. So, no, these are good. And most bacteria is very, very good for you. You need it to live.
Darlene, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Darlene Cavalier is the founder of SciStarter, and you can find more citizen science projects at SciStarter.com. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto is the executive producer. Chris Cetullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website at whyy.org/thepulse. And we really like to hear from you. Email us with your questions, your feedback, your ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.